Fields are open and the dogs are ready to hunt. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, October 21st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome Kevin Wooster, hunter and journalist. We'll talk about what the pheasant opener means in South Dakota. And we'll spend time remembering Rosie the hunting dog, who has flushed her last bird. Then, for more than 7 years, SDPB has brought you the only ongoing educational segment on financial therapy. It feels like a good time to reflect with Rick Kaler about the importance of talking about money and how we feel about it. That's coming a bit later in the hour. But first, thousands of South Dakotans walked the streets this weekend to protest presidential policies. We'll ask them what they wanted. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Nationwide rallies under the No Kings banner dominated the weekend. The overall sentiment from people who took to the streets was that President Donald Trump is behaving more like a monarch than an elected leader. We took our microphones downtown in Sioux Falls to ask people why they came out for the No Kings rally. They arrived carrying handmade signs and waving American flags. Some arrived wearing inflatable frog costumes. Some people leaned on walkers, rolled in wheelchairs, or were pulled in wagons. They pumped music, raised voices, and clanged cowbells. Thousands of people packed the community square in front of the federal courthouse or lined more than 3 blocks in downtown Sioux Falls Saturday afternoon as part of a nationwide No Kings rally. They were here to protest a presidency.
The fact that the military and National Guard are overrunning our cities for no reason.
Science is just an opinion now, and my opinion is just as good as yours, and I spent my career standing up for science and data, and it's just all out the window. And maybe I was a mad scientist at one point. Now I'm a furious scientist with the way science is being portrayed by the administration.
I'm a healthcare provider and just worried about how people are gonna get healthcare. It's in all the disinformation that's causing children to die. That upsets me.
One block to the west, around 30 people gathered to show support for President Trump.
Trump for president, yes, he needs to stay our president.
Two Trump voters broke ranks to stride the crowded sidewalks of the main rally, and they waved flags of their own.
Because I'm an American and it's my right. I believe in Donald Trump. I would like any one of these Democratic people to tell me one thing Donald Trump has done wrong in his presidency.
We respect both sides and everybody's opinion, their First and Fourth Amendment rights. This is amazing. I mean, we have no problems with people being down here to do this. Also respect the Trump supporters as well.
People gave many reasons for taking to the streets.
Principles. We have law and order in this country. We have an executive branch that is ignoring the judiciary. We got a lot of things that are going wrong in this country. We're at a president practically begging for the Peace Prize while putting our nation on a war footing with Venezuela.
I mean, you can just start with the Constitution, the very First Amendment, the freedom of speech, the right to protest, the right to gather.
More or less, we're here for conservative principles. We believe in conserving what was good about this country. And if anybody has two eyes, they can see that those principles are going away.
We're out here to show support for USAID, which was one of the first federal agencies that was terminated by Donald Trump when he took office. I'm here happily and proudly holding my American flag. I'm a proud American, and protesting is part of what makes us America.
It's an opportunity to join with a lot of fellow citizens who love the country, who are disgusted with the lack of attention to what our country's all about, and who seem to follow along the whims of a person who has no empathy for most of the world. He grew up as a millionaire. He doesn't understand anyone who has less than that amount of money to play with. This is a good country. It was a good country. It could be a good country again if it's not destroyed in the next 3.5 years.
People need to vote. come vote. Vote your conscience.
Those who support the president shared their thoughts on the No Kings movement.
Oh, I have no idea. I don't understand what their message is. No king? Who's the king? There's one king. Christ is king. So that's the one king. So I don't understand that message at all. Our message is we're waving a flag saying we love our country and we should all get along.
Support President Trump all the way.
USA.
Your sign says God bless ICE. Tell me a little bit about the work that you think they're doing that you feel supportive of.
They are cleaning up the cities and ridding us of illegal people that don't belong here unless they're legal.
Well, we're just here to support democracy despite what everybody else says. We elected President Trump, and they're trying to turn that all around into saying that he's destroying our democracy.
He just solved 8 wars. Christ is king.
One sign depicted Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem dressed in a Nazi uniform. Another showed Noem's dog Cricket lifting a hind leg to soak the secretary in an act of canine revenge from the grave.
That is genius. You win.
But most signs evoked ideals of democracy, called for resistance of the current administration's policies, and splashed cardboard-painted sentiments of faith and freedom into the air.
We the people should love each other. It shouldn't be regardless of what race or whatever. This country was designed for all people. Well, because Jesus came to love, not destroy. He came to build up. He came for the strangers, the weak, the poor, the sick, the needy. So we as people should go out for each other as well. Even though he is the King of Kings, but he came to serve, not be served.
U.S. Senate candidate Julian Baudouin made his case to the crowd.
They've used power to protect their privilege and not to protect the people. They've turned politics into personal profit, and they've traded their courage for convenience. We won't have it.
Sioux Falls mayoral candidate and state senator Jamie Smith led a rendition of God Bless America. From time to time, the crowd joined in with chants or protest songs.
Hold on, just a little while longer. Everything.
2 hours later, the permitted time for the event expired. Diners eased into outdoor seating in the cool of an October evening under leaves that have turned ochre and yellow. City ambassadors in their matching shirts and caps swiftly removed scattered bits of trash that had been left behind, and drivers honked support for the stragglers wandering home. In Sioux Falls, I'm Lori Walsh, SDPB News.
We love America! We love America!
More in the moment after the break on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Pheasant hunting opened to non-residents this weekend. That means the pheasant tourism season has started. Kevin Wooster joins us with a look back on the brood count and with a remembrance of a very good dog. Wooster is a longtime journalist in South Dakota. He's worked for SDPB and Kello TV and the Rapid City Journal. For this conversation, he stepped into SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
You know, it's a little different for me this time of year because I don't have a dog. And Rosie, you know
yeah,
Rosie well,
yeah.
And died last December at 14. And I'll be 74 here in a couple of weeks, and I'm kind of not inclined to get another dog. All the work to train a hard-charging hunting dog and keep him exercised the way you have to do and everything. So my pheasant hunting will be a little different this year, but... Still exciting, and I'll miss the great opener at my family, on my mother's side, the McManus side, back in Reliance tomorrow and the next day, and there'll be lots of familiar faces there. They're getting younger every year. There's fewer and fewer of us old guys there. And we mostly, anyway, just show up and walk and talk and have lunch in the machine shed and watch the young guys do what we did for so many years. And really, as you point out, enjoy the fall. It's going to be nice weather overall. And that's what you really hope for more than anything else for the opening weekend is decent weather conditions so people can enjoy each other's company and enjoy the great outdoors in South Dakota.
Yeah. And that's, I think, what it's about, right? That reunion aspect, that everybody's getting together. It's a family affair for a lot of South Dakotans, for a lot of residents.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And you know, I always felt in my pheasant hunting there have been two hunts, and that has been the family hunt, which is really about family. It's really about reconnecting, and it's about who had kids and, you know, sadly, who may not be here that was there the year before, but that's part of life and death. And then there is the serious pheasant hunting that I usually did with my dog, with one of the other of the dogs I've had over the years. And that's really a different hunt because it is really focused on the hunt and the dog and the birds. And it's a kind of a singular, you still enjoy the outdoors, and there's no way, finer way to enjoy the outdoors pheasant hunting than when you have a good dog that teaches you so much about what's going on out there that you with your dumb human nose can't figure out, and the dog with the brilliant nose can. So different kinds of hunts, but both wonderful in their own way.
So give me an example of something Rosie taught you in the field.
Oh, she would always teach me where birds would be that I didn't think they would be. And I thought I was a lot smarter than her. And my other dogs, too, they all taught me how stupid I was in one way or the other. And I would go and I would look at a patch of cover and I would say, oh, there's got to be birds in there. And she would have already gone by it downwind and checked it off the list. Yeah. And she would grudgingly, I'd make her go over and hunt this thing out. She'd say, kind of look at me like, okay, but there's nothing in there. I just checked it with my nose at 30 yards. I don't need to go in there. And occasionally we'd go in there and she would find a bird and it would surprise her and me. But mostly if she, all you do is you want to try and unhook your human arrogance and follow the dog. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, your dog's well-trained and well-bred, it's going to take you places you just surprise you, where birds are, how they work, how they hide, how they run. And if you get to know your dog well, you can tell by the way she's reacting, whether a bird is running ahead of you or whether it's gone off to the side. You can kind of plan that and see how urgent she is and how urgent you should be in the way you pursue it. And,
yeah.
Just wonderful.
So would it be just you and her, or were you always with someone else with her and other dogs?
Don't tell any of my hunting pals, but I loved just Rosie and me.
Yeah.
That was my favorite hunt. And
and
the fewer people along, the less confused she got, and the easier, because we were a one human, one dog, two-being unit. Mm. And it became one mind, really, and so that was my favorite way to really hunt pheasants, if you set aside the social part of it and just want to connect with the dog and the outdoors and the bird you're after. And and that was an amazing experience. I had so many years of that.
What was her reward? What was it in the field? Was there something afterwards? Like, how did you communicate to her, I guess I'm asking, that she had done a good job?
Well, the thing that she loved most was the flush.
Mm.
And if we didn't get a bird, she's enjoyed flushing a hen almost as much as she's enjoyed flushing a rooster and having me shoot it and her retrieve it. She loves to flush birds. She loved to flush birds. she would stop off, and again, there's this connection there. She would stop off and look back at me to check on, make sure that I wasn't doing anything stupid behind her.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I would praise her with great praise when she did a flush, just a good flush. I would take time to pet her and praise her, and just because there were times my wife would shake her head. She'd say, wait a minute, you didn't get any pheasants? You drove all the way to the creek. That's 2.5 hours each way. And you didn't fire a shot? And I would say, no, but we had three of the most wonderful hen flushes where she trailed the hen for 200 yards before it flushed right off of her nose.
Really?
And I like to say then we both looked at each other and grinned. She didn't necessarily grin, but in her eyes, I think she was laughing and enjoying it.
Yeah, that was a good time, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm glad you're along. I'm glad you saw it.
Yeah. Because, if you're doing it without a dog, you'll walk by most of those birds. They'll go and sit off to your side 20 feet or 20 yards and go, are you kidding me? This is the best you got. And they can't get away with that with a good dog.
Yeah. My dog used to, we never hunted together, Pippin, but when we just took a walk in the winter, she would always look back at me during the walk. And for a long time, I was like, why is she keep, so I would just say hello to her, she's just checking on me. And then I realized that she was walking over patches of ice. And then she would turn around and look at me like, look out for that ice. Because she knew I'm not the most sure-footed mammal out there with only 2 feet. And once I figured that out, I was like, oh my goodness, this dog is warning me every single time there's an obstacle or it might be slippery so that we can walk a little faster, so that we can go a little further. And you got to pay attention. Unhook your human arrogance and follow the dog. Yeah. That's what you said. Yeah. I'm going to remember that.
Rosie was a bigger Springer Spaniel. She was about 60 pounds, 55 when she was in really good shape. And I had a smaller Springer named Stormy who was about 38 or 40 pounds. And she was ahead of me on a frozen marsh one time. And about 20 feet ahead of me or 25 feet, she went through the ice.
Mm.
And then I realized, first of all, how am I going to get the dog? Because if a 35, 40-pound dog went through the ice, I'm going through the ice.
Right.
And she finally clawed her way out because I was, that's a position that a guy is, you put yourself in because you can't see yourself letting the dog go under. So you're starting to think of all these alternatives. And it wasn't horribly deep water. I'm assuming it only would have been waist deep or so, but it was cold and we were away from the car and things could get complicated. And she crawled herself back up and then I kind of followed her off the ice because she seemed to have kind of a sense for where we should go. Basically backtracked, but a lot of the ice was clear, so it was kind of hard to do that. But
Wow. Do you train your dogs yourself? Did you train Rosie?
I did train Rosie, and it's always best. I've had dogs I train myself, and that's the wonderful way to do it from a puppy. I also got a dog that a hunter and an outdoor writer named Steve Grooms, who was a very good writer, and he had a couple of books. And he had a dog named Pogo that he gave me at about a year. And he was switching from Springer Spaniels to English Setters. So Pogo was his last Springer Spaniel. And they're flushing dogs, and English Setters are pointing dogs. They don't always work together well, and he was going to make the switch. And I had hunted with Pogo a couple of times, so he gave her to me a year plus. And she was pretty well trained, but then we got to kind of mold ourselves as a unit together. Yeah. And it worked. That worked out great. She was a great dog.
So for people who are coming from out of state and listening to this, and they're trying to have a good experience, but they also want, for lack of a better word, an authentic experience. They want to have a real hunt. What's your advice to them coming in?
Well, if they have good dogs, they will find, especially the first few weeks of the season, if they get maps and go to public lands in the prime pheasant hunting range, which is generally the eastern two-thirds of the state, pretty much, although with cropland expanding out west, there's some newer areas. But take your dog and do what you do if you hunt birds anywhere. And a friend of mine worked for Game Fish and Parks named Bill Shattuck, always used to say he didn't feel like he'd hunted until he had 5 miles on his boot leather. And try to always put 5 miles on your boot leather if you can, and a minimum. Stay with your dog. If you don't have a dog, still put 5 miles on your boot leather. You need to experience our outdoors on foot as much as you can. Not everybody can, and there are some road hunting opportunities or some commercial areas that they will give you hunting opportunities. But if you're just showing up to hunt, work for these birds. Work for the experience. It's worth it.
Talk about public lands and trends that we're seeing and conservation and habitat. These are big issues when we think about We're not counting the brood count anymore like we used
wish
to
we
do.
Were, yeah.
You wish you were? Wish we were? Do you think that will come back? What's the value? Talk about that a little bit, the value of the brood count and what we lost when we stopped doing it as a state.
Well, there were generations of the brood count, and it was an imperfect process, and it was only part of an overall package that also included winter bird counts and the quote-unquote harvest, the kill, total for the year. And all of those went into trying to determine how our bird population is. And there was some concern about that summer brood count comes out and it's lower than it was the year before. And that means some of the hunters maybe aren't going to come to South Dakota and hunt. And maybe that's a negative publicity we don't need. And maybe it's not valid anyway, because the hunt can also be determined a lot on how much crop is out the early part of the season and what the weather conditions are like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still important science. And if we believe in science, if we believe in record keeping, and I do, it's important to be able to go look back. For example, in a press release, Governor Roden said some time back that we had a fabulous pheasant season in 2024, and it was good.
Mm-hmm.
We had an estimated harvest of 1.3 billion, 3 million with an M,
mm-hmm.
pheasants, and that's good, but he called it spectacular. But you have to look back. In the 40s, the estimated harvest was 7 million at one point. In
wow.
the early 30s, or the early 60s, and I remember these hunts, it was 2 to 3 million. And in fact, that returned in the late 90s, from 99 to about 2012. Every year except one, we had more than 1.3 million. We had 2.1 million one year. So you have to keep it in perspective of
right.
what these trends are important to follow, because they help us understand the rise and fall of something you mentioned, habitat. The early 60s and the 40s, we had all kinds of habitat, in part because of the war, and there was a lot of farming that wasn't getting done, and a lot of weeds grew up, and a lot of fence lines. The early 60s, we had the soil bank program, where all kinds of thick cover was available to pheasants, and pheasants went up, got the soil bank in about 63, pheasants dropped off like crazy. And then we had the CRP programs, and you can kind of track the pheasant trends based on habitat, but weather too. It's weather and habitat. And when you don't have those numbers to follow it, you don't have the perspective to manage the birds.
So what can be done, and where's that balance between, this as... I mean, you mentioned the word harvest, and I'm looking, and obviously we're talking about shooting and killing birds. And
yeah.
But when you mention the word harvest, I think of a crop.
Yeah.
And as you read a lot of the data on it, it reads like, crop production, because we want people, and it's obviously a financial and economic boon to South Dakota to have people come in and spend the money that they spend on the pheasant hunt. But it's also more than that, right?
Yeah, it is. And I have a little trouble with harvest, because making them a commodity, these are living creatures, and
right.
we kill them. That's what
right.
we do. And I don't think we should ever forget that.
It's a hunt, yeah.
The commodity thing is, it's important. This is an important economic development tool for South Dakota. And, commercialization has come along, and with that is good in many ways. Many farmers that's a side income, or in some cases even almost a primary income.
Mm-hmm.
That's great, but we've also seen a change in that. There were times when often there would be 100,000 resident pheasant hunters in South Dakota, and maybe 20 or 30,000 non-residents. That's basically almost flipped on its head now. We don't ever get 100,000 residents anymore, because they don't have a place to hunt, because so much, that's my feeling,
yeah.
because so much of it has gone commercial, and areas that they could just drive up to a farmer's door and knock a few days before the season and get a place to hunt or make connections in town with somebody aren't necessarily available. No fault of the farmers. They're trying to make money and trying to keep on the land.
Mm-hmm.
But we're seeing a decline in resident pheasant hunters, which is sad, and we're seeing an increase in non-resident pheasant hunters. And the preserves, I remember preserves where there are very few hunting preserves, and these are the ones that have the longer season than the traditional season. Special rules release a lot of pen-raised birds. And, you know, in the 1.3 million harvest, quote unquote, we had last year, in addition to that, there were 380,000 preserve pheasants killed. To me, that's a different kind of a hunt. It's not something, I've done it a couple of times, I don't like it.
Yeah.
It's not something that appeals to me personally. I understand if people do like it, that's fine. But I think we have to balance what kind of pheasant hunt we want in South Dakota, what type of outdoor experience we want. We can treat these living creatures as commodities to a certain extent, but when we take it overboard, I think we diminish them and we diminish the hunt itself.
Tell us a little bit about the other big hunt of the season for you, which is the Mount Blogmore hunt, and how the intersection between hunting and politics works in South Dakota.
Well, quickly background, we had the Mount Blogmore political blog on the Rapid City Journal website back when blogs were first a thing, and we started this in 2007. And brought a bunch of people who were fighting together and hating each other politically on our blog and comments, decided to get them together and give them shotguns and put them out in the field together, which my editor at the Journal at the time thought that was maybe a bad idea, considering it was using the name of the blog on our website. And it was a great hunt. Everybody had a good time. Nobody fought. And nobody, from that, we've been doing it since 2007, and a mix of some very conservative guys and some fairly progressive or liberal guys. George McGovern would always say, liberal, I'm not a progressive. we got along great. Larry Pressler came once when he was running for re-election in 2014. Rick Weiland came when he was running. Senator Tim Johnson came and helped us raise money for a kid with some profound disabilities in 2009, I think.
Yeah.
Dusty Johnson's been there a time or two, and I think may come this year if one of his sons can come with him, if that works out for the family.
Yeah.
And then just journalists, Game Fish and Parks guys, bloggers, you know, have a good time. And we have it at Nick and Mary Jo Nimick's place at Hollabird. And
yeah.
Mary Jo and others make some chili there and some desserts, and we talk hunting and South Dakota stuff and occasionally touch on politics in a very friendly way, but nobody fights.
Solve all the problems and nobody fights.
Yeah, nobody fights.
Will you go out this year without Rosie? What will your season look like without Rosie?
I will go out. Last year I don't think I took a shot going with me on the Blogmore hunt. We have Rosie's ashes that I'm probably going to drop at a Mary and I will go out somewhere on a spot where we hunted together.
Yeah.
Dog, I know. But I know. It's going to be different, and we'll take that, we'll say goodbye to her out there. So.
Yeah.
I will probably take the gun out and walk around a few times, but
yeah.
It may take a while to get excitement about it again.
That's journalist and hunter Kevin Wooster. More in the moment after the break. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Rick Kaler is a wealth advisor and president of Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City. And for the past 7 years, he has also been the personal financial therapist for all our listeners on In the Moment. So we thought it was a good time to reflect on those conversations for some key takeaways with Rick Kaler. I was scrolling back and scrolling back and scrolling back on the SDPB archives, and it's at least 7 years that we have been talking about financial therapy.
Wow.
And I think the first time we talked, we were asking the very basic question of how are our emotions connected to our money? And introducing you as a really leader in internationally, a leader in financial therapy right here in Rapid City, which at the time surprised a lot of people that you
very
were
very surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah. As I'm thinking about that, you know, financial therapy itself, the organization wasn't founded until around 2010. And I don't think there's probably any show in the nation that's been talking about financial therapy for over 7 years. That's rather amazing. To me, it kind of feels like 3 years. so That's shocking to me. And to your point, that it's originating out of South Dakota.
Pretty forward
and
thinking.
I've gotten that when I travel. They're like, oh, wow, you're doing this really cutting edge work. And now where are you out of, California or New York?
The financial capital of the world. Here we are in the financial center.
South Dakota. Which I do like to kind of make a point of or be obnoxious about from time to time.
How did you get interested in that work? Because I do think that people who are from here will understand the influence that South Dakota has on banking and the finance industry and regulations, trust industry. There might be some surprises there. But how did you get into the world of financial therapy?
Well, the really quick two-word answer is a divorce. And that got me into therapy itself and exposed me to therapeutic modalities and that community. It helped me discover, after a lot of money, that I did have a right brain. And I remember being in group therapy and thinking, you know, we talk about everything in this group experience except money. I thought about that for a long time and then took that idea to the owner of OnSite, which OnSite is a non-residential outpatient codependency treatment center. It used to exist in Rapid City. Decided to give it a go.
Yeah.
And that was back in 2007.
And you started making the connections in that group environment where everybody, I mean, whoever has been through a divorce, I've been through a divorce, you've been through a divorce, money is a big part of it. That is a panic attack over, people fight over money. Even if you don't fight over the money before, during, or after the divorce, you're anxious about it. Or you're not telling the truth.
Yeah, it typically plays a huge part in any partnership, marriage, business partnerships, in any partnership. And as we have talked about for 7 years, money issues are not about the money.
And that most money decisions are made using emotions.
90% to 95%. I found some new research recently suggested up to 95% of all financial decisions are made emotionally. Very few are made logically. And I know this drives investment advisors and left brain thinkers like me crazy. They have the same brain.
One of the things I remember struggling with and asking you multiple times, month after month or week after week sometimes, was like, what are we supposed to do when we have these uncomfortable feelings or emotions? And you're saying again and again, like, you have to feel them. And I did not like that answer for a long time.
Like, yeah.
What do you mean you have to feel them? That's doing nothing. That's, you're taking no action to just sit and feel something. It took me a long time to get that concept. Is that, do other people struggle with that too?
Other people like me.
Yeah. You don't want to, because it feels awful. It feels awful when you.
It feels pointless. Like to your point, it feels like doing nothing. What?
Just suffering. You're just suffering. I'm going to sit here and suffer.
And we spend a lifetime resisting difficult emotions. So it is just innate in us to not feel the feelings. And there's a step in between feeling the feelings and not feeling the feelings that we can masquerade as feeling the feelings. And this is my favorite go-to. Let's talk about the feelings. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about I'm feeling sadness. I'll talk about I'm feeling anger. Or I'm feeling this. And it took me, it was, and I may have said this before on the show, a few years ago, I had this aha that talking about a feeling is not feeling it. And I kind of got upset, like, why didn't someone tell me this 30 years ago when I started this path? And a year later, so I'm thumbing through one of the first books I ever read when I got into therapy. And in highlight is this sentence, talking about feelings is not the same as feeling them. I'm like, oh, I guess when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I wasn't ready to hear that.
Yeah. I asked that question so many times. And then what? Well, you're not done feeling it yet. Because it, you know, it shows up in your body. And you want to move past it very quickly. But the aha moment for me was one time, I think it was after you and I had a conversation, I had gone home and was dealing with some financial issues in my own life. And then I just felt that gross all over, skin crawling, you know, stomach upset, panic attack kind of feeling. And then it went away. And that was my aha moment where it was like, oh, I did in fact ride that wave. And now I'm on the beach and now I can balance my checkbook. So for me, the aha moment was not a book. The aha moment was living out something I had learned from you, just interviewing you, you know, on the radio, and then going home and feeling that show up in my life.
That is so powerful. And it is so exemplary of the point of feeling a feeling. Yeah. And I'm relating to that same aha moment in me when I did the same thing and discovered the dissipation of the difficult emotion, a lightness that came after it. And then with that, to your whole point, and now I can balance my checkbook of being able to be present, the ghost of Christmas presents, and be able now to receive the information and receive it as information.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Because I would go straight to the information. You and I are both the people who have 10 books stacked up on our nightstand. And, you know, I would go straight to the, I'm feeling stressed out. I'm going to go to the library. I'm going to go to the bookstore. I'm going to go find the next book that I need to read to get information, which was shortcutting, in my personal experience, my ability to just feel it first. Like, you might be doing that later, but probably what you really need to do is just feel this. And it feels bad.
Yes, it's typically not a pleasant feeling, which is why we work so hard not to go there. And there's parts of ourselves that say, if we feel that emotion, we'll never come out of it. That's very normal. Yeah. I just don't want to go there because it will be so overwhelming that I will be paralyzed.
Right.
And so what happens is the paralysis continues. Because in so many ways, we are paralyzed without giving attention to that emotion and that feeling. And that part of us that is screaming to be witnessed, screaming to be acknowledged by us and not discounted. You shouldn't be feeling that way. That really didn't happen. Whatever the stories are. We really try to exile those parts of ourselves and they don't go away.
Yeah. I've learned so much from you about money scripts and where I default to again and again. I think there's a real, if people go back and listen to our conversations over the years or find your work on your website, that again and again, we go back to learning about the tendencies we have. And I think I said to someone the other day, I was giving them a little insight that I thought was useful. And I said, okay, I can be a little money avoidant though. So let's make sure this advice works for you because I default to this money script and I could kind of recognize some of my own patterns. How important is it for your clients when they start to, I mean, money scripts can surprise us, but when you know some of the big ones, and how they show up in your life again and again, that can be very helpful. It's been very helpful in my life.
It can be crucial. I think it is.
Yeah.
It's crucial that we understand what our belief system is. And as we've talked about, money scripts are operating 24/7. They're unconscious until they're not. And when we bring them into consciousness, that's when they have the hope of being modified, of being updated. Some of the money scripts we have, we got when we were kids, and they worked right. You know, we've talked about stories of where parents went bankrupt and the kid lost all of their savings. And all the kid knew is that my savings disappears, and so you better spend it. Don't save it, spend it.
Yeah.
And that is carried into adulthood unconsciously without ever having a chance to be taken a look at and considered, does that still work? Why did that come about? What? And it was a good intention. Money scripts have a good intention. Yeah. And back then, yeah, they better have spent the money.
And they might be partially true.
They're always partially true.
We have talked a lot, too, about money scripts and even money disorders that we see played out in politics. We talked during the pandemic, what to do with your stimulus check, how to unpack your feelings about student loan forgiveness if it's happening to other people around you, but you didn't get this, you know, brought into your life. It can really de-escalate a lot of upset about politics as well. If you take the time to feel the feelings and to look at how the culture has been built around certain money scripts as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of societal money scripts. You got to work hard for money. That was one of mine. Lots of cultural money scripts, a lot of ethnic money scripts. So there's a lot of external money scripts. There's money scripts that we learned from our family, which we would call generational or legacy money scripts. They are all over. And understanding that, oh, this is a belief, and maybe this is not a money script that serves me well anymore in this situation. There's money scripts that about money and government, money and taxes.
Yeah. And in America, we all come from different families. Our families might come from the Lakota culture to a recent refugee from El Salvador to a Norwegian who's been here for 5, 10 generations. We all have in America a vast array of cultural influences on the stories we tell ourselves about money, which explains a lot about how we handle some of these things.
Totally. Yeah, that is so true. And I've worked with clients as a financial therapist that had came from communism.
Oh, sure.
And that's a whole different culture. I worked with a person once that went through the Holocaust, and when we hit the inflationary period, was panicked that her money was going to go to nothing, be valueless. Makes perfect sense when, as a kid, that's exactly what happened with the German mark. So there are so many influences and so many beliefs that we pick up. And even after doing this work for a long time, I run into a money script that I didn't even know was there in myself.
Yeah.
Because if it's true and it's working, that's great. But when things change and that money script isn't true, it has the opportunity now to be out in the light. Yeah. Doesn't mean that it will be recognized, but it has an opportunity to be seen.
How important, and because you have done all this educational work and you're not a paid consultant for SDPB, you volunteer your time and your insight and your research to talk to people as part of our educational mission. You don't do a lot of heavy selling, like, you know, go hire a financial therapist, go find someone, here's how they're certified. You give us this information generously. I am wondering, however, how important it is when you are dealing with your banker, when you are dealing with your loan officer, when you're dealing with your insurance agent, your attorney, your business partners, your spouse even, how important is it to sort of gauge how willing they are to talk openly about how we feel about these things? Because that's something that I've really taken forward. Like, I don't go in and say to someone, are you well-versed in these 10 things? But I can hear in people's willingness to talk about how I'm feeling about it, whether or not I really want to be working with certain professionals and in what capacity.
Really important thing to gauge. I get that question a lot, like, how can I train my financial planner in the emotional language? Or how important is this? And you can find out very quickly a person that is open to having a little deeper discussion around money. One of the questions I love is, tell me about your relationship with money. First time I was ever asked that question, I was like, just stunned. I have no words, because I at that time I could think about a relationship with nicotine or a relationship with alcohol, but money just wasn't on the radar screen. So it was deer, it got in the headlights. So that's information.
Mm-hmm. Information is good.
And if you're used to sharing on a deeper level about emotions and feelings, you will find out very quickly if those are welcome or not. Back in the day, if somebody would come in and start doing that with me, I would redirect their attention to the mutual fund chart on the wall. We don't allow feelings to get out in this office.
Right. Here are the facts. And yeah.
Let's
so how has your practice changed then as you do this work and as the research continues to advance?
Not only my practice has changed, I have changed. Mm. If there's anybody who knew me 40 years ago that would be listening to me today, they would think, what happened to Kaler? I mean, this can't, it sounds like the same voice. It can't be the same guy. And that's really important in doing this work, because I preach all over the nation and the world, you've got to do your own work first. If you're going to be a professional in this area, helping people with emotions and money, you have got to do your own work, which is transformative for yourself at the beginning. And so it has definitely transformed my practice. I think it's made me a better professional. I would have never dreamed I would be calling myself a financial therapist ever. You know, I walked out of the meeting in 1989 where a psychologist was speaking to a bunch of financial planners. And I said, what is he doing here? Doesn't he understand we're number crunchers? So it has been transformative to me. It's been transformative to my relationship with money. I have a men's group that, it's been around long enough. They remember I'd go comatose if I had a cash flow problem. And several years, maybe decades ago, they're like, wow, you don't go comatose anymore. So it's transformative, and it needs to transform the professional who is promoting it.
That is wealth advisor and financial therapist Rick Kaler. He's president of the Kaler Financial Group. You can find 7 years of financial therapy on our website, sdpb.org. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us here at In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.